I will adjourn, not adjourn, I will call to order. Wow, it's one of those mornings, right? We just want to get done. No, I will call to order the House Education Finance Committee. And the first approval, first order of business is the approval of the minutes. Representative Jordan, would you like to move the minutes for March 13th?
Madam Chair, I will make a motion to approve the minutes for March 12th.
March 12th, yes.
Because I think today is the 15th, so I don't have minutes yet for the 15th. So I will make a motion to approve the minutes of March 12th. And I think they look great. And I ask for members.
13th, because today's the 14th.
Okay.
The minutes
are actually the 13th. It just has the wrong date on the top.
Yes.
We're sorry about that. So.
Date. I'll make a motion to move the minutes in front of me, and I trust the clerk will make sure it is the correct date on the piece of paper that we end up putting in the official record.
Thank you so much, Representative Jordan. I think everybody's really tired today. Representative Jordan moves the minutes for the approval of the minutes for March 13th. Are there any other questions on the minutes with the technical correction? Any other questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes for March 13th, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. The minutes for March 13th for the Education Finance Committee have been approved. Thank you, members. Now let's move on to Representative Norris, who has our first bill on the agenda, House File 4117. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Norris. Once you get settled, go ahead and let's see. I will move House File 4117 before the committee because I always love a good discussion around local operating revenue and equalization. So with that, Representative Norris, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. House File 4117 aims to further the state's investment in our public school students and educators while bringing more parity to school district funding across the state. The bill has several features. It increases the local option revenue amount by approximately $200 per pupil, a figure that hasn't been adjusted since it was established in 2014. It establishes a cost-based reimbursement for a school's unemployment insurance costs and paid family medical leave expenses. And it reduces disparities among school districts with varying property tax bases by increasing the equalization factor for both local option revenue and the operating referendum, meaning more assistance to low tax base districts. I have two testifiers joining me today who will share more about the benefits of increasing state aid to our schools and increasing property tax fairness across districts.
Thank you. With that, first testifier, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And thank you for the opportunity to make a few brief remarks in support of House File 4117. I want to thank Representative Norris for carrying this important bill that would significantly enhance the stability of our education funding system. Last session, Madam Chair and members, you all approved a tremendous investment in our schools and made significant progress towards stabilizing the funding system, specifically linking the formula to inflation, reducing the cross subsidies in special ed and English learner, and allowing locally elected school boards to renew an existing referendum were a tremendous help in bringing greater stability. House File 4117 would bring further stability and greater equity to the funding system. Local optional revenue is an important funding stream, providing just over 6% of general education revenue on a statewide basis. However, as Representative Norris noted, it has been frozen at the same level since it was enacted about a decade ago. Likewise, the equalizing factors for LOR and operating referendum have been badly eroded by inflation over the years. On a statewide basis, referendum revenue and local optional revenue comprise 15% of general education revenue for school districts. For some districts, that number is significantly higher than that and is even more important for their general fund. House File 4117 would make great strides towards stabilizing these two important funding streams. I'll stop there and leave it to the two following testifiers, to share a little bit more information. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. And with that, maybe Mr. Strom, can you just briefly go over the runs that are in our packets? I'll just describe them, please.
Madam Chair, members, there's a printout on legal page turned sideways for you that shows the a couple of things, including the impact of House File 4117 using the February 24 forecast estimates for fiscal 26, which is the 2025-26 school year. This printout's organized like many of those you see in the committee, with the strata grouped at the top and then individual districts listed in district number order following. The pupil count is in the first column, then the referendum market value, which is the tax base that's used to equalize the referendum, and that tax base divided by the pupil, the resident pupil units, then gives the tax base per pupil column. And that column you can see there in the second column of up and down the list, you can see the average district's tax base per pupil of referendum market value is $905,398. And then it gets into the calculations of the existing formula and then the proposed change. So under baseline for fiscal year 26, it's estimated that local optional revenue will total $616 million. About 90% of that's paid through the local levy, and 10% comes through the equalization aid, which is, as the tax base keeps growing, provides less support each year. Then the next column over shows the existing UI summer aid based on the 24 estimates that this committee discussed yesterday, as well as about $8 million of unemployment insurance levy that school districts did in Pay 24 based on the levy for their permanent layoffs, which is ongoing authority they've had for a number of years. The total of those two is about $47 million. So the combination of those two programs is about $664 million. The alternative that's proposed in Representative Norris's bill is to increase that general allowance for local optional revenue from $724 to $920 and then adjust for inflation. So you can see that that pushes that amount up to $784 million, adding in then the UI to that amount adds another $47 million for a total of $831 million. That's a $167 million increase in revenue shown in the next column, and you can see that for this year, that revenue increase is essentially a fixed amount because the UI estimate is the same used in 26 as was for the 24 year, $196 per pupil of additional money. Then the next two columns are for information only at this point in time. We don't yet have a good way of estimating the paid family and medical leave costs that districts are going to face. Others may want to address this. The business manager that's here today may have a thought how his district will shake out on this. As members may know, that bill passed last year, and employees could face a tax rate of 0.3%, 0.4%, or 0.7%, depending on the programs they have. And if they have qualifying programs for their employees otherwise, they wouldn't face an additional rate. So as a way of providing information for you, I've used a 0.3% rate against the payroll for the each district to show what kind of fiscal implication that would have for the district. And that component, as Representative Norris said, is going to be added to the formula. It's a reimbursement basis, so it wouldn't show up until fiscal year 27 at its first year, but just so members have a sense of how much that would be. Then on the perpetual issue, we get in this committee about how to do equalization. Often these bills are drafted before we know what the forecast information is going to be, so we try to back into an equalizing factor. The goal with this bill and others that have been introduced on local optional revenue have been to keep the property taxes at the same level statewide. The equalizing factor under the existing program is set at $880,000 for the first tier and about $600,000, depending on the year, for the second tier of LOR. Combining those into a single equalizing factor to fund the proposed program in House File 4117 requires an equalizing factor of $1,245,000 if it were all done on LOR and not split between local optional revenue and the referendum. I think the author's goal is to split that between the two, but for purposes of getting this all on one printout, it shows the effect of keeping the property taxes the same statewide. So the last three columns on the printout then say choose a $300,000 property, and remember this is referendum market value, so it doesn't have the class rates involved, and you can see statewide those amounts are the same. $300,000 house in Black Duck or Wayzata or wherever is going to pay the same amount of tax based on the overall tax base. The state average is $205, but depending on the composition of the rest of the tax base, the more property wealthy districts will have a lower rate, and you can look up and down those rates there to see where the rate is under current law and where it goes with the new equalizing factor and the higher revenue amount. And again, that second column from the left, if you go all the way back to the left, that's sort of the magic number for equalization. That's the individual tax base per pupil that's going to be set over that equalizing factor. So I apologize for the relatively long explanation, but there's a lot of material on this printout, and just want members to understand what each of these columns represent.
Mr. Strom, I just wanted to make sure I caught it too in the bill. So instead of going to the average net tax capacity of the individual district, how our first and second tier do for LOR, it moves it to the statewide average that goes up for inflation?
Madam Chair, no, it changes the equalizing factor. Both are still based on referendum market value, but it pushes that equalizing factor up to a higher level so that the same amount of local levy is incurred statewide. They're shifting amongst districts. In general, the lower tax-based districts are going to be getting more state aid, while some of the highest tax-based districts are going to get an increase in their individual levy.
Yes, and then it collapses both the tiers, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bennett, you have a question for
Thank you,
Mr.
Madam
Strom?
Chair. I do have a question for Mr. Strom. And Mr. Strom, the other day I was asking you to read my mind, and today I'm going to probably ask you a question that has no answer, but I'll try anyway. And obviously all this is so complicated, and there's different, not for you, but for me. So here's my question. If a school district used their local option revenue levied up to the full amount that they are able to do throughout the state, all the school districts, what's the range of equalization? And I know it's different for every district, but could you tell me, like, some districts will get 10% equalization and others will get 90% of that cost there? Did you get my question? I'm not sure if I'm making
yes,
it clear.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, that's a really good question. I sort of ran out of columns on this printout. On the spreadsheet itself, though, if we take one of the districts, I believe, in your area is the Alden-Congdon Conger School District. District 242, they're very low tax base, relatively low tax base for pupil, as is Albert Lea. Maybe we just use Albert Lea for convenience. District 241, and you can see that under the current or under the equalizing factor for them, it's about $494,000 per pupil, which is less than or is about half the state average. So under current law on the aid levy split for that district, under current law, there's $2.5 million of revenue, and $1.7 million of that comes from levy versus $800,000 from the state aid. So about a third is state aid in a relatively property poor district like Albert Lea. Not to pick on anyone's district, but just because it's real close by, if you go down to Red Wing, just a few districts down, the Red Wing School District has $1.1 million of tax base per kid, quite a bit higher than Albert Lea's. And if you look at the same mix there, out of their $1.8 million of revenue under current law, that full amount comes from the local levy because their tax base per pupil is over the equalizing factor. So the tax base per pupil is really that measure that counts, and the range of revenue of state aid as a portion of that revenue varies as well depending on the district's tax base. As I said, statewide it's about 10%, but for districts more situated like Albert Lea, it's about 30%. For districts situated like Red Wing or some of the suburban districts, it's 0% aid and all levy.
Representative Bennett, yeah, follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Strom. You should really be a teacher. You did a good job with that. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Bennett, we're not allowing him to retire at any time. Thank you, Mr. Strom. And with that, we'll go to our first testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Joaquin, committee members, and Representative Norris. My name is Jeff Holmberg, superintendent with Centennial Schools. I'm here to testify in support of House File 4117. I'm representing the Centennial Schools community, which includes Blaine, Centerville, Circle Pines, Lexington, and Lionel Lakes, as well as two partner organizations, the Association of Metropolitan School District, AMSD, and Schools for Equity in Education, SEED. We support the proposal to increase the local optional revenue formula. LOR has remained stagnant for the past 10 years since its inception, and we advocate for the increase to $920. The bill also links local optional revenue to the formula to prevent erosion to inflation in the future. We strongly advocate for aligning future LOR calculations with inflation to provide a consistent and indexed approach that would bring stability and predictability to our budgeting process. Since our community is predominantly residential, tax relief is our top priority. And this bill promotes greater property tax fairness by increasing the equalizing factor for both local optional revenue and operating referendum, and equalization is paramount to our district. So we support any measure to reduce the property tax burden on our taxpayers. Secondly, this bill has several important provisions. This bill allows school districts to use local optional revenue to be reimbursed for costs for unemployment insurance and paid family medical leave. Temporary funding for unemployment insurance costs has been provided, but it will be an unfunded mandate when the funding runs out. As an example, this past summer, unemployment insurance costs for our district surpassed $300,000. And we anticipate a further increase in the upcoming summer of 2025. There is currently no identified funding stream for paid family medical leave, so school districts will have to use general fund dollars revenue in order to cover that cost when the program goes into effect. A sustainable funding mechanism is crucial to ensure continued success of these programs without placing an undue burden on our budget. We extend our gratitude for your commitment to addressing these vital issues and look forward to the future of this legislation's positive impact on school districts and communities. Thank you, Representative Norris, for authoring this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Superintendent. With that, next up is Director of Finance and Operations at Minnetonka Public Schools, Paul Burgoyes, which you will have to pronounce for me. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair Yukim, it's Paul Bourgeois with Minnetonka Public Schools. I'm here testifying on behalf of also AMSD and MASBO and MREA. And thank you, Representative Norris. The testifiers have talked a little bit about property tax equalization and that measure. So I'm just going to talk more about why this is really important to every school district in the state. And I'm going to use a metaphor. I wore my battleship tie today because our school districts are kind of like they're Minnesota's fleet. We're the fleet that kind of fights the battle against not being educated, against time. We have 13 years for each of these students to come through our systems, and we have to do the best we can. We're battling every day to take every student up as high to as high a level of learning as they can go to, so they can get their achieve their best aspirations. But no money, no mission. But we're steaming along out there, but we're taking some hits. And inflation is just a torpedo that just is hitting us. It's hitting everybody. The mandates in these are a couple more torpedoes in the water that are going to hit us. And as previously stated, it'll reduce the amount of money available to spend on our students. And again, there's good reason for those mandates. So we're not saying that they're not appropriate. But the thing is we really need you to figure out a way to help us fund them. The $196 is, I'm going to mix in another metaphor, the $196 is is going to be like a man in the desert stumbling upon an oasis. Right now, the MSD districts are at cumulative $317 million of budget reductions, and that's probably because of inflation. I mean, we're having to take care of our employee groups because they're actually getting just hammered. And every school district's general operating fund budget is 75 to 85% salaries and benefits of the staff that actually help these students become the best they can be. The reason we have $920 in there, if you take the original tier of the $424 from July of 2014 when we first got it, utilizing the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator, that'd be worth about $552 right now. Through February with the latest in statistics that they published, just published for the CPI. And then the inflation calculator from July of 2020 for the $300 tier, that would be worth about $359. So you're talking about $911, and when we're proposing this, it's like by the time we get these funds, there'll be additional inflation because we won't get them until July of 2025. So we thought $920. It's a nice round number in that regard, but it's also reflecting there'll be additional inflation between now and then. So, again, this is really important money. It's going to be important to every single school district in the state if you can find a way to do it. I know there's going to be a tough budget biennium next year. If you can find a way to fund this, it'd really be received by a bunch of grateful school district, school boards and school district personnel. Thank you.
Thank you, Finance Director. With that, I believe we can go to member questions. Lee Finish. Oh, did I hear, see, Representative Crucia. I clearly have not had coffee this morning. Lee Finish, would you mind if you go at the end? Okay, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was comical. So thank you to the testifiers. And how do you say your name again?
It's French, Bourgeois.
Bourgeois. So, Mr. Bourgeois, thank you very much. Your expertise, your boots on the ground perspective is really helpful. So maybe this question could be to Mr. Bourgeois, could be to Mr. Norris, but that local option levy, can you just clarify who decides that?
Mr. Bourgeois?
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Yes, Representative Bakeberg, it's local optional. So literally the school boards have the ability to levy anything from 0 to 724 right now. It's been that way from the initial initial startup of it. Most of the districts are going to the top, but there have been some districts in the past when equalization was a little tighter that are not utilized in full amount.
Representative Baker, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Bourgeois. And I think in your testimony you talked about some of these mandates that were passed last year. We had a conversation yesterday, but and just for the sake of time, I'll answer my own question. But Mr. Bourgeois or the school districts or represented, they did not decide on paid family medical leave. They did not decide or advocate for unemployment insurance. What they're doing now is asking for a funding source for this, because if those two things have come or are coming, and if there's not a funding source for this, it will result in budget reductions even further than the $300 million that AMSD has talked about. So, thank you for getting creative. It's a wonderful creative idea on how we look at things. But I think this is going to, depending on equalization, this will be an increase, or could be, depending on factors at the local level. And it puts the onus on our local school boards to have to make determinations on how to fund programs that they did not ask for. So that's the tension that I see in this. So this, in my opinion, this bill is really trying to cover the new mandates that were passed by the DFL last year. It isn't new money. It is trying to cover the mandates from last year. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions before I have a few? Seeing none, I'm not sure Representative Norris, who would be the best person, maybe Mr. Grunquist.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kuhnquist, I want to thank you, too, for the creativity around this, especially with the local optional revenue piece. Mm-hmm. I've carried a bill for that for 3 years now just because we're stuck in older numbers and the property values have increased. And I see you left it scale by leaving that one piece open to see how much we could cover. And increasing it to $920 hopefully will help some of our districts. And then doing the equalization factor higher will help some of our districts that can access that equalization. I represent three that have zero, and it goes all on our taxpayers. So I think that's important. With the UI piece, can you tell me, I think I remember from our presentation yesterday, one, districts haven't had to pay anything yet because we have the pot of money. But two, what do you do for your other employers when you do have the employees that had qualified in the past for UI? How do you pay for that? Don't you have a levy stream that does that as well?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, there is an existing unemployment levy that school districts use that are not allowed to use it for the new benefit that was passed last session. What we proposed in this bill was to repeal that existing UI levy and to use this local optional revenue option to cover all UI costs. And the thought behind that was the existing UI levy is not an equalized levy, so it's all levy for every district. And whereas the local optional revenue does have, it's still a decent equalization levy. Obviously, we're hoping in this bill to also raise that. So that was the idea behind shifting it over to the local optional revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhnquist. And can you tell me, besides the paraprofessionals, who else in your buildings qualify for UI? Under the old law.
I might have to phone a friend or turn to it to Mr. Strom. I mean, there's a wide variety of employee groups.
Yes, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, the current unemployment insurance levy covers all employees if the layoff is permanent. So essentially, it doesn't have to do with what category of employee they are. It has to do with whether the termination is permanent or not. And one note about the estimation of that, and business manager Bourgeois or the superintendent Albert could speak to this, is because the districts actually don't know the amount for a couple of years, they on the levy forms, they put a round number, their best guess for that year, and then it's actually two following levy years later before the final number gets keyed in. So there's always an adjustment 2 years after for that, because they have to estimate ahead of time how many people might they lay off during the next year and put that on the levy. So that adjustment's full 2 years out. So that current cycle for that is sort of a three-year cycle. So just in case members are looking at the individual data and wondering why a district may say their unemployment insurance levy is $200,000, that's their best guess, rounded, of course. But it's really not until 2 years later that number is finalized.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And then one last question from me, and then I'll see if other folks have questions. Can you remind me, and I know it depends on the contracts, but there's already current employees in the school districts that have paid family and medical leave. Is that accurate? And who would they be?
Madam Chair, there are. Mr. Bourgeois might be a better option. I don't know if you have any information on that, Mr. Bourgeois. I'll turn it over to him because I might be able to give you a better answer than I can.
It's really the There's not a specific designation, but there's the Federal Medical Leave Act. That's pretty much what we work with right now. So a lot of it does go unpaid. So the paid family medical leave actually is going to kind of backfill on that.
Thank you, Mr. Bourgeois. It's my understanding, too, though, a lot of the administrators in our buildings have this in their contracts. I've heard that before, but I'll have to clarify that.
I'm not aware of that in any of the contracts in my district, but that doesn't mean that they're not out there in other districts.
Thank you, Mr. Bourgeois. Thank you for your patience.
Sure.
And now you all know how I felt when I got up to a school at 7:15 a.m. in the morning and found out subbing that it was a French immersion, and it took a long time for me to get that. So thank you. With that, members, any other questions before I go to Lead Krisha? Lead Krisha, you're up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And In all respect to what we do down here, you know, there's a lot of things that can be true at the same time. I think we can all recognize that taking care of employees and helping school districts is very important, as well as the students that they serve and the families. There's no argument there. And how we get to that, there's lots of ways. So I'm not going to ask a lot of questions of you. Thank you, Representative Norris. I'm just going to make some comments. We'll do a 2.5-hour beat up on the House. No, I'm kidding. But here's what we're faced with as a finance committee. We have a spreadsheet. Mr. Strom went through it. These school districts now have liabilities. They have additional liabilities. When you look at a balance sheet, you have liabilities, you have assets, and you balance those. Because of the budget that was passed, and we had a very large surplus last year that was all spent for lots of different reasons, but it was spent. And in that bill, and I appreciate, I don't appreciate some of the school groups that come up, because you were in our offices railing against mandates after mandates after mandates, and you knew this was coming, and now we're here saying, well, thank you for all this. I'm not saying anything negative to the majority party of the chair. You put the bill together, but we do have groups here that were playing a thin line of, yeah, we know the mandates are coming, but we're willing to eat those in addition for this. Well, now you have this. You have unfunded, and not my words, these came from testifiers, we have unfunded down the road liabilities that are going to have to be accounted for. And the argument and the challenge that's in front of this committee and this legislature in years to come is, how many dollars are we going to take out of classrooms for other liabilities? The LOR hasn't been adjusted since, I think, 2014. I actually think this should go to the tax target. But it won't go to the tax target because the tax committee doesn't want it, because they're going to have to raise money, which means they're going to have to raise taxes. And I get it. This is fantastic in some respect. We have an equalization. But to not say this is not raising taxes on the property side is to ignore the fact that if we were to put this in the tax committee, we would have to raise taxes somewhere else. The dollars are not just printed. So again, I'm not talking about the merits, or I don't want to talk about the value of the programs we pass, but we do have assets and we do have liabilities, and this is a liability that will have to be funded. It will have to be paid for. Something like this will probably have to pass, or there's going to have to come more money. But either way, what the school districts are saying, which is very, very true, and it's a problem in front of us, is the general ed fund is not going to cover all the expenses that are out there, and more of those dollars may be coming out of classrooms. That's the position we're in down the road. And we're already hearing from the finance director and the superintendent, as I'm hearing from many, many schools, saying we just don't know what the economy is going to look like. And people are very fearful of the uncertainty that's going to come in the next budget cycle. My recommendation to this legislation is, or this legislature, is let's back off the liabilities. Let's find some more flexibility so that these schools can dig out. Because if we keep piling on, and like I said, you're probably going to have to pass an LRA equalization. You're going to have to find money from somewhere. But the reality is we have to back the liabilities off. We have to give the schools some breathing room. Or at the end of the day, the classrooms and that tough decision of where a dollar goes will become more and more difficult. So good luck with your bill, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Lee Kusha. And you and I agree on the one thing, that it should be in a tax bill because it is a property tax cut. Equalization should be there, but we also owe our schools some measure of stability in the fact that kids shouldn't depend on where they live and their zip code and how they're funded. And some districts don't have the tax capacity to fund at the same level. And we're lucky in Minnesota that about 80% of our aid to schools comes from all of us collectively. In some districts and some states, it's almost all borne just by the local taxpayers. So it's a balance. You're right. It's absolutely a balance, and as is in all our decisions up here. So I do appreciate you in your comments. So thank you. Representative Norris, final comment.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Just briefly appreciate the conversation we've had here with the committee. I think this bill is a good conversation starter. It takes us in some positive directions, increasing state support and investment in our students and our educators. It brings more parity across districts depending on their property tax base. And so I look forward to continuing that conversation with the committee in the future.
Thank you, Representative Norris. And thank you for bringing this bill forward and being willing to dig in equalization is not always exciting, but it is very interesting all the time.
I have an entire page of notes here from Mr. Strom yesterday, so I appreciate his efforts.
Thank you. With that, members, we will lay over House File 4117 for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. And next up on the agenda, we have Representative Hicks for House File 3780. Another very just uncomplicated topic with special education funding. All right, as soon as you get settled, Representative Hicks, Representative Clardy, would you like to, oh, sorry, Representative Vernig, would you like to move House File 3780 before the committee? Representative Vernig moves House File 3780 before the House Education Committee. Representative Hicks, your bill's before us, and I believe you have an A3 amendment.
I do, Chair. I do have an amendment.
Thank you. Do you want to briefly describe it?
Yes. The amendment is designed to really get the bill in the shape that everybody thinks it should be in. We have worked tirelessly as a team, talking to all of our stakeholders to make sure that we get this right. So that's what we're doing here.
Thank you. Representative Vernig, would you like to move the A3 amendment before the committee? Thank you. Representative Vernig moves the A3 amendment in front of the committee. Any questions on the A3 amendment to get the shape in the bill the author would like to discuss it? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. The A3 amendment has been adopted. Representative Hicks, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee. Special education is complicated. It's complicated for students, it's complicated for families, it's complicated for teachers, it's complicated for districts. And there are pieces of it that are complicated for various reasons. But one of the pieces is paperwork. There are federal requirements, there are state requirements, and then there are also protections that are needed. And so finding a way to reduce paperwork and really look at how we can use special education funding to advance students with special education needs, making sure that they are included as a priority and represented as a priority, while also making sure that our teachers can do the wonderful job that they do of teaching. So they aren't spending so much time doing things that are not teaching and not in the best interest of supporting kids and families. So the bill before you today has two sections. The first section takes care of a issue around DAPE assessments, which is for adaptive physical education for students with disabilities, making sure that those assessments, when they're needed, can be done without having to do a whole big hoorah-rah of other assessments that are unnecessary to get the student what they need. The second section of the bill, which is primarily in the amendment at this point, really allows us as a state and as a community to bring folks together to talk about how can we do this differently and how can we do this better in a way that honors everyone's position and place in this space. So that's the bill, and I would love my testifiers to share information as well.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. First, I want to say thank you for being willing to dig into this when we asked, and for all of those around the table who helped out with this. I know it was a big endeavor this summer to get a lot of the stakeholders together. And we all talk about SPED paperwork here, but I think maybe briefly before we bring our testifiers up, you did speak about paperwork and took care of the DAPE issue, but what else did you find out that you told me about? It's not just about paperwork.
It's not just about paperwork. So there is a lot that is about paperwork, but there is also districts, lots of districts, who are doing a variety of different things to be in compliance. And how do we do that better? How do we do that more efficiently? How do we give the support that our districts need to make sure that as they are deciding whether they want to have this form or that form or how they're going to document different things, that that's really helpful and clear, both for them but also for our families, so that families can feel confident in how that is going. And then the other part is the special education formula and how can we make that be reflective of the work that our special teachers do, not just with students, but also with paperwork. And how do we take a look at that formula and make sure that the way that we're doing that includes and incentivizes inclusion and makes it so that we can start including with disability, people with disabilities when they're little, so that when they are adults, they're part of our communities and they haven't been excluded from their peers. And so how do we do that in a way that works for everybody and brings everybody together so that everyone can work towards an inclusive Minnesota where people with disabilities are considered full and equal partners?
Thank you, Representative Hicks, and thank you for your work. So we'll go to our first testifier, which is, Ramona Springs Das, special education teacher in 196 that is remote. So Ms. Das, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Ramona Springs Das, and I am a special education teacher in District 196. I have been a teacher, I think this is my 27th year. When I started in special education, I was able to write an IEP in 30 minutes. Today, it takes 10 hours. There's a lot of pages that have been added over those 20 years. It also takes 20 hours to assess a student. So I spend a lot of time during my working day assessing kids and doing paperwork. On average, I spend about 9 hours a day at school and 20 hours on every weekend at school. The last time I talked to Justin, I think I figured out I'd had one day off since the beginning of the school year. Paperwork is excessive, and it interferes with a teacher's ability to deliver quality instruction to students that need it the most.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
With that, we have Maren Christensen-Hofer. Please come to the table and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Maren Christensen-Hofer. I'm the executive director for a nonprofit organization called the Multicultural Autism Action Network, and I'm also the parent of a child with a disability. And I'd like to start by saying thank you to Representative Hicks for bringing this bill and for really playing such an important leadership role in this discussion about paperwork and school funding. I mentioned in an earlier hearing that I think we've made more progress on this issue in this year than we have in the past decade by bringing stakeholders together to just have a really honest conversation about what the paperwork requirements are, what's required by state and what's required by federal law, and what teachers are actually being expected to do. And there's a big difference between those two, so thank you for bringing us to that discussion. I'd also like to talk about the funding aspects of this bill. There's a lot of really amazing things that are happening in our schools and some fantastic work that our special education teachers are doing. But quite frankly, we're also spending a lot of money on things that really don't work very well. If we look at our outcomes for students with disabilities, you know, we hear a lot about how only about 50% of our students are doing reading and math and science at proficiency levels. But when you look at our students with disabilities, that drops to about 25%. And if you look at our students with disabilities who are also people of color, we're talking at about around 12, 13%. And that's something that should really be keeping us all awake at night. I know it does for me. The other thing that we really need to talk about is the inclusion settings. Right now we have, I think, around 35% of our students in Minnesota are students of color. But if you look at our most exclusive federal settings for students with disabilities, where they spend very little time with non-disabled peers and sometimes are in completely separate buildings, about 50% of those students are students of color. Why is that? Again, that's something we really need to dig in closely. And that's not to say there aren't a lot of really amazing things that are happening in our schools. We had a fantastic example recently of the school Nellie Stone Johnson in Minneapolis, which came up with a very inventive program whereby they were able to reduce their disciplinary calls by 75%. And the way they did that was simply by offering kids breaks when they need them. I mean, it really didn't cost the school much of anything. And that alone is a really admirable goal. That's a fantastic thing. But think about how much money the school is saving by doing that. Think about all of the paperwork that they don't have to fill out. Think about the suspensions and the expulsions that are not happening. Thinking about the emergency IEP meetings that are not happening. Think about all the forms that staff don't have to figure out. That's what we really need to discuss. And again, I'm really grateful to Representative Hicks for bringing this group together. I'm grateful for all the amendments that really clarify not only what we're going to talk about, but who is going to be at the table, and glad to see that parents and advocates are part of that conversation. So again, I thank you for this support of this bill.
Thank you. Members, I think that is it for testifiers. We didn't have any members sign up to testify publicly, so we'll go to the table. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Chair Joaquim. Thank you, Representative Hicks. And just to repeat what's already been said, it was last year we said, oh, you know who would be great at looking at paperwork for special education? Representative Hicks. And so I'm just taking credit for recognizing.
you should.
So, but I truly, what I am grateful that you've done the beginning. And I understand, especially in your mind, this is just the start of the work that we need to do and that you will follow up on. And so I will remind the policy committee, and I will remind this committee too, is that there is some great work that can be done that will really improve the education and the lives of the students that we're talking about with special education. And that as we do that, we're addressing the workload. We're addressing the wasted effort that's going on right now, and that's not directed towards the education of our students. And so your work, and I think the reasons it's worked is that everybody knows that your motives are to do the right things for our kids and not just to kick the can down the road, ignore the problem, but that you're doing that and you're out there to make it better for our kids, and that you know that the people you're working with are doing it because they want to make it better for our kids. So thanks for the work that you've done, and thanks for the commitment that I see for you right now that you're making to continue this work into the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pryor. I also, would you briefly, we should have gone over this right in the beginning too, will you talk a little bit about the amendment and the possible costs that's brought you here in front of the committee today?
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. So. The amendment, if you take a look, is about bringing people together in a more formal way. So we did that this summer. We had big groups, and I am so thankful to MDE for helping coordinate and work with, and the School Board Association and our Special Ed Directors Association. I'm looking all over the place for all of the folks. The Children's with Disabilities Consortium, Disability Law Center, OMHDD, MDE, and we started the conversation. And what we learned from those conversations is that it is so much more complicated than paperwork. Like, I wish it was just paperwork. That'd be super easy. I could have done all of that. I could have wrapped that up, tied a bow on it, and been done. But it's not just about paperwork. It's about the admin rules that affect the funding formula and how they are working or not working for schools. It's about the fact that our special ed teachers are asked to have one prep period and also do 35 IEPs and 17 evaluations and manage 14 paraprofessionals, right? It's also about that school districts are not always clear on what kind of documentation may be asked if they are taken to a due process hearing, so to prove X, Y, and Z component. And so some districts have 5 forms, and some districts have no forms, and some districts have 32 forms. And parents just want to make sure that their kids are getting what they need and that everything's okay. And you can't have those conversations informally. It's too hard. And in the special education community and the disability community, it sometimes can feel adversarial. That is just a statement of fact. And it's not because anyone's trying to hurt anyone or do anything wrong. It's because it's hard. And when we have to do hard, we have to do hard formally. So that's what the second part of this bill does.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Edelson.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. And my phone, of course, rings like right as you call my name. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for your work on this. I came to the first meeting that you guys had, which was amazing, and it was so great to see the group come together. I really appreciate the fact with your amendment that you're doing an external consultant. I think that's a great idea, honestly. So often we pass laws in this building and we don't always truly reflect on like a just massive reevaluation of how we actually are doing things. And you are absolutely right. It is district to district IEP. How the whole process is done is so different. And as one mom that has children in special education to another mom that has, I know as well, children in special education, you can feel as a parent as though you have done something wrong, that you just don't know what to, are you helping your child enough? I mean, I love the DAPE assessments, you know, that's separate, that's great. I remember having conversations because our son has a physical disability and it being like this big deal to do it. And I felt bad for the staff. But you, so I think there's this disconnect in terms of what's required and what the parent needs, what the child needs, and what the teachers have to do. And it just feels like in conflict with each other sometimes, and it shouldn't. So just, I just want to thank you for your work and your dedication and everybody that did the work.
Any other members before I go to Lead Krisha? Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. So you're right on so many different things on this. I mean, and I've seen over my time here, we have gone over and over and tried to reduce the special education burdens that are out there. And thank you for identifying there's a huge difference between just the paperwork side and what really happens. Here's what I would offer. First of all, and I should ask a question. I'll ask Representative Hicks to the bill author. Do you have a consultant? Is there a consultant identified already, or is that just an open process?
Representative Hicks. So there is not a consultant identified at this time. I am hopeful that MDE will be able to use different mechanisms to execute the contract quickly.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you. And so my last comment is this. Wherever you go with this, if you get it, great. But I actually think you could just mandate MDE to do this. Don't give them any money. There are plenty of people in this room who've had these conversations. We've had an auditor that's given us. We have the information out there. And I would even submit to you, if you came to me with a bill that said, here's 10 things we're going to repeal, I'll help you carry that. And then when all the special interest groups show up and start talking about and defending it, I'll help you. Because these are hard conversations, and every single thing that's going to have to be repealed is going to affect somebody somewhere, but we have to reduce the liabilities and the burdens on these schools. We have to start somewhere. So I appreciate the road you're going down, but I would also submit an alternative path. If you can't get there, this information is out there. Lots of this information has been looked at many, many times, but you mentioned the challenge. The challenge is when you come up with 10 repeals, that's when people start coming out and fighting to keep those back in. And we are going to have those hard conversations. Good luck with your bill.
Thank you. Representative Hicks, closing comments.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that we could just do stuff. It's true. We could. We could just do stuff.
Recording in progress.
But even, well, that is awkward. but even if we just do stuff, if the districts have extra paperwork because they're nervous about something, well, then we didn't really do stuff. And even if we just do stuff, if kids and families feel like they aren't getting the protections they need, then we're going to have more lawsuits and districts are going to make more paperwork. So we're not going to actually do stuff. If we just do stuff, we're going to leave people behind. Yeah, we could. We could do stuff. We could say you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that. We could change the transition age to 16 instead of 14 and see if that works for getting kids into college when the rates of kids with disabilities going to college are already less than half of their non-disabled peers. I mean, we could do that. But when we do those things and we don't have conversations with community, we don't build trust and we don't make it better. We take parents and people with disabilities, and we pit them against the people that are legally required to provide them services. We can do that. We'll have a lot more lawsuits. It'll be really fun for everybody. So I am hopeful that together we can build community, we can build consensus, and we can build real solutions that work for everybody and bring everybody to the table in a way that benefits kids with disabilities. Because when kids with disabilities get good, high-quality instruction early on, when they are included, when they are at the table with their peers, eating lunch and learning numbers, they become adults who are in our workforce and who are living in our apartments And we're using less supports and less services because they have natural supports and natural services and people in their lives that they can turn to for support and help. It's good for Minnesota, it's good for people, and it's good for our country.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. And with that, will renew the motion that House File 3780, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the education finance bill. Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Vernick with House File 4788. Welcome to your committee. When you get settled, go ahead and move House File 4788 before us with the intention to lay it over for possible inclusion in a education finance bill.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I motion that House File 4788 be laid over for possible inclusion.
And go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. In front of you today is House File 4788, a bill brought forward by graduate student advocate Ms. Kalia Pringle. This bill would require school districts to provide parents and students identified as needing additional support through the MTSS framework a list of resources from organizations that provide culturally responsive assessments. Ideally, this list of resources would be curated by maybe the Department of Education and or the University of Minnesota Center for Applied Research and Education Improvement, or CARI. It would be updated annually and indicate if the organization accepts prepaid medical assistance programs, has a sliding fee scale, or even offers pro bono work. Identifying organizations across the state or those who offer remote assessments would also be beneficial. Education is a social justice issue of our time. From literacy to special ed services, we have an opportunity to make improvements, both big and small. This small bill will have a big impact. As a parent of a student with an IEP, that journey can be profoundly challenging and frustrating and overwhelming, as we just heard with Representative Hicks' testimonies. I am a cisgender white woman. I speak English. I have an amazing partner. We both work. We have insurance. I drive. I live relatively close to every service imaginable. I work in education. I'm on the PTO. I'm a former school board member, and I have friends and family who are deeply rooted in education. And when it came time to navigate assessments for my youngest, it took tapping into every resource I had to get him an assessment, which still took a year and a half. My spouse and I spent countless hours on the phone. We were on over a dozen waiting lists, and it took multiple visits to providers to finally get to the IEP process. During this time of uncertainty, I was given two pieces of advice. Don't let your child participate in the reading recovery program or be unnecessarily labeled EBD because he will never graduate. You see, though I work in education, I am not a teacher. The best description I had for my child at the time was EBD. It was incorrect, but it was all I knew. Because of this advice, we pursued an assessment in kindergarten earlier than normal, and we replaced EBD with awaiting assessment from the professionals. I can only imagine how difficult this process is for someone with an ounce less of support. Having access to a list of resources of any kind would be helpful, but having them from organizations that provide culturally responsive assessments is a small step forward to that road on educational justice. With me today testifying is that graduate student and advocate, Ms. Kalia Pringle.
Thank you so much. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Kalia Pringle, and I first want to thank Senator Quaid for authoring this bill for me. I don't know how she got me in front of you guys, but she worked her magic. And then I want to thank Representative Vernig for hounding me down yesterday, letting me know that I had a hearing this morning. So I'm really grateful. My name is Kalia Pringle, and I'm the state director of the Minnesota National Parents Union, and I'm a recent graduate of Metropolitan State University, receiving a master's in secondary urban education, schooling, pedagogy, and curriculum. I'm here today to shed light on the critical issue of racial disparities in special education services, particularly around emotional behavior disorder. The research conducted by Professor Elizabeth Schultz and her colleagues at the University of St. Thomas Law Clinic has unearthed systemic structures that disproportionately affect Black children in Minnesota. Reading proficiency for Black children has been debated for many decades among scholars, educators, and politicians and others. Many argue poverty is the main factor and contributor for the gaps that exist between Black and white children. The federal definition of EBD, while comprehensive, leaves room for subjectivity, potentially allowing implicit bias to influence diagnosis. This raises alarming questions about the overrepresentation of Black children in special education services. State law such as Minnesota's broadened the definition of EBD highlights the need for a closer examination of how diagnoses are made and how they impact students' lives. Much of the research I found was on how the process and the label of EBD disproportionately impact Black children. Historical data from as far back as 1998 reveals troubling trends with Black children consistently overrepresenting in special education programs. Legislative efforts such as IDEA 1997 Amendment to IDEA and the 2004 IDEA Act aim to address these disparities by mandating data collection and revising placement policies. However, despite these measures, racial discrepancies persist, as evidenced by recent data showing Black students compromising 40% of disciplinary actions despite only representing 11% of student population. Furthermore, the lack of systemic reporting to gauge the impact of special education services on Black children interactions with the criminal justice system is deeply concerning. This oversight underscores the urgent need to comprehensive reform to ensure equitable access to education and prevent the stigmatization and marginalization of Black students. Also, I believe we can save some money and paperwork, as discussed this earlier. With so much overrepresentation in special education, it is my belief with some cultural competency, responsiveness, and guidance, services may be something as simple as groceries as opposed to an IEP. In conclusion, the data presented here paints a distressing picture of the state of special education services for Black children and other children in Minnesota. It is imperative that we address these disparities head on by implementing evidence-based policies. Thank you for your attention to this critical issue.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, members, we'll go to questions from the table. Seeing none, Representative Vernig, thank you for bringing a simple bill that can make a big impact. And closing comments, please.
Yeah, thank you for your consideration of House File 4788. Accessing services is hard, but having a list of resources for organizations that provide culturally responsive assessments doesn't have to be. There may be more work to be done, but this is a great way to start the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Pringle. Representative Vernig, sorry. Clearly need more coffee. And the reason why this bill, I should have said this before us, is because it is adjusting money that we gave. It's not adjusting the money, but it's adjusting a bill where we provided money for last year in MTSS and Compass. The bill itself doesn't cost anything. So with that, Representative Vernig, I renew the motion to lay over House File 4788 for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. And members, we will be meeting Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday next week. We're working on the schedules as we speak. And with that, have a great weekend, and we're adjourned.